Blog Talk Radio.
Carol the Coach. Sex, love, and relationships. We talk about it here.
Carol the Coach. Compassion with contemporary relevance.
I am a psychotherapist. I can be your personal life coach, and I can help you with your issues. There are no problems too small or too big. You can talk about anything.
Speaker, columnist, radio TV host, and commentator. Carol the Coach brings messages of wellness and empowerment within reach of everyday people every day.
Almost 5 years ago, I lost my soulmate in an accident. He was killed in a plane crash. Life just, for me, has seemed to stop.
There are groups all over the city. I mean, I teach one. It is a specific way to start thinking so that you shift how you see the world, which then shifts your energy, and then you feel better, and you actually see things differently.
Carol the Coach. Always available to at carolthecoach.com.
Now, I've got Russell on the line.
I'm 47 years old. I'm a truck driver. I am married. I have a wife in San Francisco.
Okay.
I haven't been home in 6 months. My thing is, I don't know if I have a sex addiction or what the problem is. Why do I want what I can't have? And as soon as I can have it, I don't want it anymore.
You're right on target when you say, I don't know if I have a sexual addiction. Well, guess what? Yes, you do. And you know what? That's my specialty, Russell. So you're at the right place. Continue.
I meet women online, and I'm in a different part of the country. I travel all 48 states, so I love sex.
I hear self-esteem issues. You never felt good enough, and you didn't feel like you were getting what you should have then, and you're reenacting that now. Do you want to change that about yourself? I got an interesting email this week. He says, thank you for taking my email in question. My girlfriend and I listen to you on the radio, and she respects your opinion as I do. So here's the question. I've been separated for 9 months. I'm working on a divorce. Is it okay to date? I believe it is. But she's not comfortable with being around people who know my divorce is not final. Can you help? He kind of answered it when he said, if she's not comfortable, it's not a good gig. And Pat, you have some questions about dating?
I am 58 years old, I've been divorced for years. I was watching the Oprah show the other day, and they were talking about...
They were talking about sexual desire.
How does that factor in if you're after menopause?
Obviously, being postmenopausal, you know, you aren't going to have the same pheromones, but then the men you're probably going to be dating, they're not going to have that need to mate with you, for children. How do you feel about hooking up with somebody else?
To bring Carol to your station...
Hello? Hello?
Tom, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. I'm sorry. You know what? I went in a queue. I didn't know if that's what I was supposed to press, so I left and I came back. So I apologize.
No problem, Tom. We are glad to have you on the show. How are you tonight?
Very good, thank you.
Excellent. And we are so excited to be hearing about your book, The Problem Was Me, How to End Negative Self-Talk and Take Your Life to the New Level. Tell me a little bit about what made you decide to write this very entertaining book.
Thank you. Well, you know, it started really, I didn't realize it, but I had a very interesting journey in my life. You know, as a kid, I was a victim, a legitimate victim. I mean, things happened to me that weren't fair, things I didn't deserve. But I developed what I call this victim mentality from there. You know, I wanted the world to pay the bill for what happened to me as a kid. And when the world couldn't do what I wanted it to do, what I developed was this destructive entitlement. You know, somehow I gave myself permission to act in ways regardless of the way it harmed myself or others. Now, as I grew up, I was a real successful businessman, but when it came to relationships, I just sabotaged everything. I didn't know why. And it basically got to the point in my life was that I was going to sentence myself to a very lonely life unless I took responsibility, unless I really realized that I was damaged goods and I had to find out what was broken inside in order to know what had to be fixed. And that's when I started to go on this journey. You know, when I had addictions, I was sabotaging everything. And eventually, I came up with this kind of methodology that really helped me heal the insides to help me allow love into my life. I started 10 years ago to run some groups in schools and churches and in my house, free of charge, helping other people that that had the same destructive messages that I had growing up. And then eventually a couple of therapists whose clients came to my groups suggested I write a book to get this out more, and I did that. And some others told me to go back to school and do this professionally, and at 53, I graduated with my master's, and now I'm a life coach. So that's kind of the quick way to explain the journey and how the book came about. And the funny thing was I couldn't come up with a name for this book, and every time I came up with a name, my wife would goof around and just, you know, give me the little look. And then one night I came to her and I said, "Sue, I got it. The problem was me." And she said, "It sure was." And that's how the name came about.
Yeah, I was saying that I really admire you for writing that title, because I do believe that we are all 100% responsible for
right.
what we do with our lives. No matter what's happened to us, we need to get out of that victim role and know that we can empower ourselves to shift that energy. And that's what you teach in this book.
Right, right. And it is all, as you said, Carol, all about responsibility. And without that, I was never going to be able to look within. You know, when you're in pain, I mean internal pain, it's so much easier to look at the shortcomings of others rather than look at yourself. And I realized that that is what I was doing. And you know, the other thing, I didn't want to hand this stuff down to my kids, as my father handed it to me and his father handed it to him. And I could tell you, one of the greatest things that I do today is I really have helped people, you know, give their children the positive messages that were denied to many of them in their childhood. And it's a great feeling when I start to hear these messages change in the family history.
Yeah, and certainly as I read your story, I mean, you know, we all have our stories, and certainly many people who suffer from sexual addiction suffer from drug or alcohol addiction.
Right.
You suffered with gambling and
mm-hmm.
spent so much of your own money and the business's money, and yet at some point you decided to take hold and change that. Do you remember what it was that actually shifted you into saying, okay, I'm 100% responsible?
Yeah, I think it was a few things. It started with my wife leaving me. You know, there's no greater teacher than life. And only when sometimes you're, as a recovering addict, and other addicts could identify, only when you're in enough pain do you really have the willingness to take direction and to change. So that was the beginning. But I think another breaking point for me, or aha moment, was when I visited my father in the hospital. He had gone to many rehabs for his addictions, and he had become a different person. And he was very
ill. You saw that through how he worked with your kids, huh?
Oh,
I mean,
he was.
Really,
he became a wonderful grandfather to my children. Wonderful.
Yeah.
But to me, he was still a 10-foot monster because of my childhood. And you know, my father, if he didn't come home at a certain time when I was a kid, it meant he was going to come home drunk. And if he came home drunk, it meant he was going to hurt someone. So I spent a lot of my childhood at the top of the stairs waiting to run down and protect my mother. So I had a very tough relationship with him. But when he was dying in the hospital, I went to visit him one night. And as I was sitting there, he said, I wanted to tell you that he said to me that he was sitting where I was sitting 20 years prior. He says, and his father was dying of lung cancer. He says, I could never tell my father I loved him. I could never tell my father I cared about him. And he said, I don't want that to happen to you. And with all of the hate that I had, and the love, because that's the way it is with dysfunctional families, is an enmeshment, a love and a hate, I felt him, with all his pain, trying to understand my pain. And as I got up from the hospital, I went to say goodbye. He pulled me closer, and he started to cry. And my father never cried. The only time he cried is when I was a kid. If he beat the heck out of you drunk, he'd kind of say he was sorry in a very drunken way. But this was different. And I think after he died, I started to read his journals, and I realized this wasn't a monster. This was a human being. He was me, and I was him. Same fears, same resentments. I think I right-sized him, and I really believe that that helped me then start to trust others again. And that's the biggest problem as a recovering addict, is trust. We're hurt so bad in childhood. The thing we have to do the most is the thing the hardest, trust others as an adult.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Now, at what point did you begin to see specific roles that kept playing out in your life, that of the warden?
Right. Well, that's my book. My book is about my life story and the story of other women, men and women that have found a better life. And I talk about this warden. This warden is that little inner critic inside our head that doesn't go away, that little voice that constantly reminds us of all the things we're doing wrong, never allows us to celebrate victories. That little that warden always showed me that if anybody ever got close to me, intimacy was something that should be avoided. And I listened to the warden my whole life, and I pushed others away my whole life. So this warden becomes that little inner voice that we listen to. And what I've really have helped people, I do marriage counseling and individual counseling, and I run four groups, and I really teach people how to understand where they're warden came from, so they could stop listening to his commands, its commands, and really find a better life.
Mm-hmm. So tell us about some of the other roles that you saw play over and over again in your life.
Well, I know in my life, it's very easy for instance, many of your listeners tonight, I'm sure many of them play the role of a caretaker, where they take responsibility for the world, yet they don't know how to let it go. Many of us play the people pleaser, where we say yes all the time because it's too painful to say no. There's the invisible role, where we disappear in our relationships, the defiant role. We're all set up to play these roles by this warden, this little inner voice that develops in our belief system. And what I talk about is how we get caught up in these roles. I was a caretaker. Somehow it became my responsibility to make sure that my mother and my brothers were taken care of. I didn't matter. So whenever I tried to take care of myself, I had such guilt. How I had no right. I had other people to take care of first. So this is the role I fell into. But as I said before, I have many roles in my book that I'm sure many of your readers can identify with.
Oh, 100%. And certainly, you know, you've just identified some of the roles, the victim, the caretaker, the people pleaser, the invisible. Can you share, because obviously you break those down and you give examples of people that have suffered these same roles, you discuss three essential elements that a person needs to change their destructive behavior, and I was wondering if you could discuss them.
Sure. The most important and the first is awareness. You know, we have to be able to become aware of kind of a time-traveling process where we make the voices of our past, our caregivers of our past, and we confuse them with the people in our lives today. How many times do we hear our mother or father's voice in our wives or husbands or bosses, and it distorts our ability to listen as well as our ability to hear? So we have to put these childhood messages on paper, bring them to the light, really become familiar with them so we could see how they affect our life. So the first essential is awareness. After we build enough awareness, it makes it much easier to see the actions we have to take. The second essential. Now, actions, even if they're good, are uncomfortable in the beginning because you're really getting out of your role. And nobody wants to get out of their role. You're not going to feel like doing this stuff, so you got to do what you don't feel like doing. But the actions become clearer with the awareness. And finally, the third essential is maintenance. If we don't maintain these different actions, that warden is going to come back and take care of our behavior again, try to control our behavior again. So to sum it up, without awareness, you can't take action. And without action, there's nothing to maintain.
Okay, and then repeat again, because you said with the awareness comes the understanding of what?
Of this time-traveling process. It's a process.
Yeah.
As you become aware, you start to see how many of the stories you make up in your head, the situations that you live through in life, are really because many of the messages or the voices of your past, your parents, whoever were your caregivers, your grandparents, priests, rabbis, teachers, those voices get mixed up with our present-day voices, and it creates a distortion in our ability to hear people and listen to people.
Okay, so you're saying you kind of look through your own life with a filter because of your past experiences. And when you become aware of that, then you can create a different kind of action plan.
Right, you understand it better. And Carol, you said it better than me. That was excellent. But that's really what it is. It really is that we hear things, and how we hear things is affected by our childhood messages. You know, our messages, verbal and nonverbal, they're ingrained deep in our soul. And those messages unleash a tsunami of thoughts in our adult life. And all of those thoughts are affected by that time-traveling process.
So what would you say some of the very common messages, what are they that addicts so oftentimes hear? There should be some common ones.
Yeah, I'll tell you something very common, and this is something that I try to give my children, and that is permission to make mistakes. You know, the warden came down on me heavy whenever I stumbled in life. So it's very important to give our children the message that You can make a mistake. It doesn't mean you are a mistake. You can fail at times. It doesn't mean you are a failure. You know, if we negate or deny that part of our humanness, we're taking away a crucial part of compassion. We won't have compassion for ourselves or have compassion for others when we stumble. So I think many people that suffer from destructive childhood messages believe that they weren't allowed to make a mistake. They internalize themselves as a mistake. That's one of the key components. And another very important component is it's so important to create a safe environment for our children. A place where they could share their feelings or cry on their parents' shoulders. You know, I as a kid, my father, whenever me and my brothers did anything that made him mad, he would address us as girls. He'd say, "Come on, girls, let's go." Mm-hmm. That was a message that told me that if I was to feel or God forbid, cry, it meant I was defective. And I never, ever wanted that to be handed down to my children. And, you know, I can tell you that, you know, we had an incident where our dog passed away, and my son was very shaken by this. And I went in his room, and I put his head and shoulders on my chest, and he started to cry. And I realized I was giving my son a safe place, a place to cry in his father's arms, a place I didn't have as a kid. So this is some of the stuff that addicts don't have, but in a healthy household you do have. And that is a place to share your feelings, to know you can say things even if your parents don't want to hear it, but you know that they love you and you're safe enough to say it. And if you need to, you have a shoulder to cry on. That's the important thing.
Well, and you know, Tom, as I read the book, I felt it heartbreaking that you did, you know, your father was so critical and he was an alcoholic and he did belittle you so much. And then you went to school, a Catholic school,
yeah.
And there seemed to be more abuse in the school than there was even at home, in that everybody got terrorized at school. And
yeah.
And so yeah. You just didn't have a safe place anywhere you went.
Right. And but you see, you know, what you say is said is so important. If I had a family at home that I could come to and say, things happened to me that weren't right, I didn't deserve, and they would have held me and said, "You're right, you didn't deserve this." But when you have a family that not only doesn't do that, but they reinforce that you deserve it, I could never take it home because my parents would have somehow felt I deserved this kind of action, just reinforcing that I'm damaged goods, like that I'm defective. And all of these things, you know, we hear in the paper about bullies and victims. And in my opinion, many times a bully and a victim suffers from a very common denominator. They both suffer from an inner pain. You know, that victim feels that they deserve to be hurt at times, and the bully is acting out their pain, hurting others the way they're hurting inside. So, you know, that's how I really can see myself as the victim to the bully, and now I can say I've been a hero to my children and to others.
Well, what we certainly know about addiction, and especially sexual addiction, is that many people that suffer with the sexual addiction, they reenact the trauma that they experienced in their own childhood.
Right.
And that's why I think it is so good that you're saying that we have to allow kids the opportunity to make mistakes and let them know that's normal, and then we have to create a safe place for our kids so that they know they can come to us with anything, with their feelings and their experiences.
Absolutely.
Now, you said there were three things. So what's that third thing that we have to give our children a healthy message?
Well, there's a few. And another one is we have to pick our battles with our children. You know, sometimes we have to give up being right and choose being close. Mm-hmm. You know, we have to guide our children, there's no doubt. But we also have to be able to listen to them and be able to help them. Sometimes we have to let compassion lead us in the way we talk to our children and what we say and how we say it. So it's really important to pick your battles. If you're always in the "I gotta be right" mode with your kids, you're gonna push them away. And also, sometimes what I always think of is two other things. Basically, is I have to monitor my inner critic. You know, if I have an inner critic and I'm not exposing this inner critic and working on changing this inner critic, I will give this inner critic right to my children. And that's where my book really helps people not give this inner critic to their children. And finally, I have to search my inner child. You know, I believe that when my child, I have two sons, two daughters, when they're really hurting inside, sometimes I got to pause and say, okay, what would I have wanted to hear from my parents at that point? You know, really look at me being that little kid who's really suffering. And what would I have wanted to hear from my parents to know that I was safe, that I was okay? What would that sound like? And maybe let that lead my language to my children.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely. So then, you know, you are saying pick your battles and don't feel like you have to be right sometimes. To back down and really have empathy for the child takes you both into a deeper relationship where, both of you feel safe.
Right. It's choosing closeness over being right. I mean, we have to guide our children. I'm not saying not to do that. But, you know, there's those instances when our children know what's right and wrong. Maybe they need just to be listened to be close. And I think that's important. And I also talk about celebrating your child's victories, you know. And what that means is when your child does something that they're proud of, I don't care what it is, it's what they're proud of, not always what we're proud of. Celebrate that. You know, even if it's getting a B on a test that they know they worked hard on and it's not an A, or getting a base hit in a baseball game and not a home run, take your kid to get a slice of pizza and ice cream. Celebrate that. Let them feel that inner victory, not the outer stuff that we get from society, the trophies and stuff. That inner victory is really important to celebrate.
Mm-hmm. Well, I 100% agree with you, and I really feel like a lot of my clients get stuck in that situation where they had such horrific childhoods. A, they're reenacting the trauma with their own kids, but B, there's a little bit of them that has so much anger that they don't want to give the child something that they didn't get themselves.
Right.
So obviously, when they're struggling with that, because again, that just equals the amount of pain they're feeling, what would you advise them to do?
We can't give our children what we don't have. And if we don't have compassion for ourselves, it's really hard to allow our children to have compassion for themselves. I realized in my journey, one of the most important things I had to gain was a relationship with me, to know that I was okay, that I wasn't a bad person that deserved to be punished. I was a discouraged person that needed help. And as I developed compassion for myself and a relationship with myself, I was able to have my children and wife come close to me. Until that time, that warden led my actions. He just basically said, listen, Tom, you know intimacy was painful and fearful as a kid, so why the heck would you want intimacy in your adult life? Why? And I had to realize that I had a very distorted definition of intimacy as a kid. As I work with people, we write down what was intimacy like as a child. Well, if it was something that was fearful and painful, you can avoid it as an adult unless you learn how, unless you expose those messages and you change those messages and start to have some compassion for yourself.
Well, and I think we all know when we meet people that are healthy or healthier than we are, it's easy to really ascribe to want them in our lives, but then ultimately you start sabotaging that relationship if you don't work on yourself. And indeed,
right,
that is what happened to you with your wife.
Absolutely.
You thought she was the best thing in the world, and you almost had to fake it because you couldn't be your authentic self because you were too afraid she'd abandon you.
Absolutely. And abandonment is a huge word for all of us, not only addicts, but anybody who acts out with addictions, acts in with depression. That fear, abandonment, some people think is a physical thing, but it's also abandonment of your needs, a feeling that you're important. And I think that what I did with my wife is my parents would fight terribly in front of people publicly. And I thought, again, I was going by my distorted messages that a good husband is one that never shares their feeling, just is a do-gooder. You give your wife what you want, you never complain. And along the way, like many addicts, I lost my right to feel. I lost that right. And when you lose that right, you either shut down or you have so much pent-up anger, you rage out. But either way, what the outcome is, you're pushing the ones closest to you away. That's how you sabotage this stuff. And if you start to feel and you're in a relationship that's good, many people will say, I don't know why. Every time I'm in a relationship, stuff happens. Well, again, that warden is in there. You may not fully realize it, but he's going to show you the ways to sabotage it if you feel that you don't deserve to be loved or happy.
So as you began to really work on the negative self-talk, what happened to the warden?
Well, it was, again, the awareness. It's, again, to expose the warden. You know, in my area that I work in with others, we constantly will bring up the warden. He's somebody that we constantly talk about how he tries to do things, and we constantly say, thank you for sharing, take a walk, because it's very ingrained in our belief system to hear these messages. But I think that what happens is when something's triggered in me, when something tells me that that I'm defective again, that warden will come right out and start in on me. The difference is that I'm aware of him now. I don't have to listen to him now. He's still there, but I can silence his commands by talking about it to others. This is a we process, not a me process. To get rid of your warden, you can't do it alone, but you can do it if you have the help of other people that you're safe with, not anybody, safe with, that you can help each other silence each other's warden.
Yeah, so do you have a title or a name for that healthy part of you that seems to be in control, at least aware of what he needs to do next?
Well, you know what? I talk about this in one chapter, that there's a battle going on. As you start to learn this stuff, you start to have this newer belief system with the positive messages battling the warden and the old messages. And in the beginning, sometimes the warden wins, sometimes your newer affirmations win. But if you keep, again, the maintenance, the third essential, if you keep this to the light and talking about it, the warden just loses its power and volume, and then you start to become comfortable in new actions, in new roles, instead of being uncomfortable. And that's really when you're making progress.
And so I would assume that that takes quite a bit of work, quite a bit of practice, and quite a bit of almost forgiveness when the warden gets stronger, or when you give in a little bit to the warden and you start to feel defeated.
Right.
You do a lot of talking about forgiveness in your book.
Right, right, right.
Tell us a little bit about forgiveness. What does that mean to you?
Forgiveness to me is really how I really set myself free. And I'm not coming up with anything new here, but I set myself free from drinking down the poison of resentment. You know, and again, it resentments in people that are wounded internally happen because it's easier to look at other people's stuff than our own stuff. But when I got to the point, especially with my father, that I saw that he was not this monster. He was just like me. He was somebody that had a very discouraged childhood, and he really was a good man, but he was covered up by a lot of pain and a lot of resentments. I think it started to right-size everything in me, and that, you know, for me, it was people weren't personally trying to hurt me. They really were people that were hurting inside themselves. And I think when I started to see that more, that it wasn't the world's out to get me, but rather some people are just hurting and they don't know any better. Now, I don't have to have those people in my life. Don't get me wrong. It's not a question of, you know, allowing them to hurt me again, but it's certainly a question of accepting that they are damaged goods as I am, and that they're not trying to hurt me. And I think I started to say to myself, you know, if I want forgiveness for the wrongs I did, it's only fair I forgive others for what they did to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's very, very, very powerful. And self-forgiveness is equally as tough to do as even forgiving others.
Absolutely. You know, and I think that's what my book really deals with, is perceptions. You know, I, as a child growing up, eliminated people. I eliminated God. I eliminated everything but me. I mean, I had to survive my childhood, and I developed these qualities of selfishness, of control, self-reliance, and they weren't character defects as a child. They were what I needed to survive my childhood. Unfortunately, as you grow older, these same qualities become character defects and hurt a lot of people. But, you know, I never realized that why I controlled so many things in my life is because as a kid, control was linked to survival. If I wasn't at the foot of the stairs when my father came in, somebody was going to get hurt. So I had to control everything to feel safe. Unfortunately, that's the time-traveling process again. As an adult, I'm trying to control everything because it's linked to the survival I had as a kid. And that's how this stuff gets all mangled up.
Yeah, it's like you developed the defenses you needed to survive, but at the same time, used to the extreme, they end up backfiring and creating more distance and inability to trust and to be with close to others.
Exactly.
Now, I'm curious because obviously in the book, you did have the gambling problem, true?
Right. Mm-hmm.
And you started in the direction of being unfaithful. I mean, your
right.
father had been unfaithful, and you found
right.
yourself having the same problems. Did you see yourself as a sex addict, or did you see yourself as a lost soul at that point?
I went into a very lonely place as just somebody that was just isolated from everyone. And you know, I went from addiction to addiction, or as I call it, false solution to false solution. I thought that when I gambled, that the money that I could win would fix what was broken inside. And obviously all the money in the world wasn't going to fix that. And I thought even with women that that would fix my brokenness inside. I stopped my gambling because I didn't really fix what the real problem was. The problem was me, not mm-hmm. the external stuff. I picked up, you know, the womanizing. And that became my next false solution. For me, I remembered saying to myself, I would never, ever, ever do the things my father did. And I remember when I did have an affair, and I came home, and I remember walking in the shower and literally scrubbing myself red.
Raw.
Because I hated my skin. I remember looking in the mirror and saying, I am my father's son. I'm bringing in the same insanity he brought in. And I just remembered that night so full of self-hate, that I just didn't want to let any human being near me, any human being. And, again, it was just damaged. And, you know, all of these, you know, when your morals don't coincide with your actions, that equals shame. And that's what I had tons of.
And so how old were you when you began to see the light and you realized that the problem was you and that you could change who you were and be the person you wanted to be?
I was probably about 30 years old when I started to just say, you know what, Tom, all you're doing is you're going from one false solution or addiction to the other, and it ain't working. You know, you're going to therapy, retreats, you're going to these 12-step fellowships, and, yeah, you're stopping whatever you're doing at that point, and you're just jumping to another false solution. And I knew that I just had to look and see the damage that was inside. All these things helped me. Believe me, the therapy, the 12 steps, the meetings, sobriety groups, the retreats, they all helped me. But it was really until I started to get in touch with, you know, what was going on that was driving me to constantly ruin everything, that at that point, that's when I started, as I said before, I started to feel a little compassion for myself instead of beating myself up. And that's what really turned it around for me.
And so at 30, you know, so many of our listeners are 40 and 50, and they're really still struggling. And your point about digging deeper and finding out what's underneath the need to cope like that and what's underneath the self-hatred, that's really at the key to changing a lot of your behaviors and accepting that the problem was you and that you, if the problem's you, you can change the problem. Is that
right.
accurate?
Yes, and one of the things I really believe, my philosophy, my groups and counseling and everything is that much of this is connected to the intimacy. I think that as a recovering addict, as somebody who's damaged, I have such a had a tremendous fear of intimacy that whenever I got of age that I started to become able to be intimate, there were so many red flags and fears that went off in me that is what really made me want to go to something to change that feeling. And what I focus so heavily on now in these groups is strictly intimacy, because I think even sometimes, and I've seen many people sober in their fellowship and they're not happy. And they're not happy and they're not getting closer to their spouses or to other people, but they're sober. And if you think that's the deal, you're missing here. Because as you state, you can stay sober. But if you're not working on your fears of intimacy, on why some people go to, you know, 12 meetings a week not to go home and be with their spouse, you're missing the boat. So I deal heavy into intimacy issues. What was the definition? How do you avoid it as an adult? How you can learn to communicate properly, to listen properly, and to get closer to those in your life? That's huge, because that fear of intimacy will take you right back to some really questionable behaviors.
So I'm sure there are people listening that are thinking, this guy sounds like he knows what he's talking about. Can he help me? So what would you recommend? Because obviously you have done workshops, you have written a book, like you said, you're doing group work with people. Is there anything that you offer beyond your own specific location?
Yeah, I think, again, the only thing I can offer to people is to build that self-awareness and then to go get the help of others, professional help, to help you walk through this stuff. I think that, when we talk about issues like this, there's so much fear involved with intimacy in particular that it can paralyze somebody to the point that they just can't move their feet. And I think you really need to grab the hand of somebody professional, somebody that, well, in my case, that has been through some of this stuff before, to help guide you through this. And I mean somebody that's been through this stuff before. A lot of times I believe that a lot of my experience, and don't get me wrong, I learned a lot in my master's program at Rutgers that I graduated, but what I teach, my philosophy, comes from my experience and going down deep with me, going down to the point of really, really connecting on what was intimacy like as a child and what am I so afraid of as an adult. And when you go really deep, and that's a lot of awareness I'm talking about, but that's how you build the journey to recovery, is really to build up that awareness.
Okay, so you would tell people that they really need to increase their awareness, but they also need to work with a professional who has expertise in intimacy building and who can really focus on that, because
yes,
that's at the core of the problem.
Absolutely, absolutely.
That intimacy is about trust.
And if you think about it, it's the first thing that an addict or other people that had a traumatic childhood lose is trust. Now you're being told that this is what you need to get healthy. I mean, that's a tough thing right there. The thing that you lost immediately is what you need to use to get healthy. Not easy.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So if they want to check out your website or order your book, how can they do that?
They can go to Amazon.com or BarnesandNoble.com. It's ebook, e-reader. And they can also, my website is theproblemwasme.com, and they can leave questions, anything. I love to answer any questions. I have some other interviews on there and blogs and stuff they can research, and I think they can get some good insights.
Well, yes, and what I really love is how you have transformed this into a mission statement to change the lives of children.
I love that. Yep.
Yeah, I'm amazed at it. You're there to help people, but you're really there to help people to help the children of this world get healthy, because really they are our future and they deserve a better life than we have.
Yeah, I'll tell you, I'll just share this with you real quick. It's, you know, I went to my parents' teachers' conference. And as we were leaving, the teacher said to me, you know, can I talk to you for a minute? I said, sure. And she said, I just wanted to tell you, she said, your son is so proud of you. He always talks about you. She says, I hope that my 2-year-old and 5-year-old someday talk about me the way your son talks about you. And for somebody where I came from to hear something like that, You know, my son had a Little League game on Sunday, and he had a bad game. And he came to me after the game, and he goes, and he's 11. He says, you know, Dad, I need a hug. And this is the kind of stuff when I hear him or I hear another couple have these kind of conversations with their children. To me, it's not just helping that person, but to change the messages that are handed down from generation to generation. I'll tell you, it's the best. It's the best.
Well, and absolutely, it goes back to those messages then that, you know, kids are allowed to make mistakes, and we are a safe place for them to come and share
right.
their feelings and help them emote. So, Tom, thank you so much for writing the book, The Problem Was Me, and giving me this interview. I know that there are a lot of people that you're really going to be making a difference with. And what I also heard you really saying is that you have spent a lot of time giving back. Once you found the answer that you were the problem and how to improve your sense of self and your negative self-talk, you shared that with others, and you're making a difference in other people's lives, and I just thank you immensely.
Well, thank you, Carol, for having me. It was a lot of fun. Thank you.
All right. You have a great night.
You too. Bye-bye.
All right. Well, as you can see, you know, every single person, no matter how wounded they have been, no matter what they've been through, can turn their life around and make a difference in the lives of their self and in others. And, you know, somewhat like this interview, I think we had some technical difficulties at the beginning, but boy, I could see the minute Tom came on, the technicality stopped, and that was no accident. So I'm going to encourage all of you to do what I ask you to do at the end of every show. There will only be one of you. I want you to fearlessly have the courage to be yourself, and I want you to go out there and look for ways to find the support you need to make a difference in your own life first and foremost. And then you can start making a difference in the life of others. And I think Tom would probably say you can do those things simultaneously, but you've got to keep working on yourself. So look for ways to develop more intimacy in your life, to build the trust, to self-forgive, and then pay that forward to your kids, to your spouses, and to your environment. I'm going to see you next week at the Impulse Center. They're going to be talking about how you know if you have a sexual addiction and what you can do about it. They have some workbooks that are free on their website to help you get clear about yourself. Have a great week, and we'll see you next week. Same place and same time. Talk to you later.